do, and thanks for coming. My name is Rich Cabrola, and thanks to Jeff Mistry from the Fuller Lawn Society of Orange County for inviting me here today. And thanks to Lauren and John and the rest of the crew. Without them, it would, like, it's, so the audio is important. The program today includes the Wild and Wacky Symphony No. 6 by Shostakovich. I'll explain why. The Corsair Overture by Hector Berlioz, and with the remarkable Emmanuel Acz, who was sitting right there about 15 minutes ago. And I was sitting right there watching him. He was warming up the piano, playing the Chopin Concerto No. 2. And since the Shostakovich will be the least familiar to most folks, I'll spend most of my time with that, but we'll go over the Berlioz and the Chopin as well. Berlioz wrote the Corsair Overture during a stay in Nice. He originally gave this piece the title of La Tour de Nice, the Tower of Nice, and Berlioz conducted the premiere the next year. I have to share a review with you of the first performance. You may recall the hero of the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz, who overdoses on opium and has these wild dreams. I'll let you determine what the reviewer was smoking. It is an extremely original composition, full of weird effects and bizarre flights of fancy. It is like a tale by Hoffman. It plunges you into an indefinable malaise. It torments you like a bad dream, fills your imagination with strange and terrible images. It must be the case that nowadays this hour is inhabited by hundreds of owls and ospreys. And the surrounding ditches must be filled with snakes and toads. Maybe it served as a lair for brigands, or maybe it was a fortress of some medieval tyrant. Perhaps some illustrious prisoner, some innocent and persecuted beauty, expired there in the pangs of hunger or under the executioner's sword. Actually, by the way, it was a Starbucks. You can imagine and believe everything when you hear these strident violins, croaking oboes, lamenting clarinets, groaning basses, and moaning trombones. The overture of the Tower of Nice is perhaps the strangest and most peculiar composition to have been created by the imagination of a musician. Okie dokie. Thank you for sharing. So the work underwent a few revisions between 1846 and 1851. Along the way, it got itself a whole new name, but not the one you expect. It was renamed Le Corsair Rouge, as in red, after James Fenimore Cooper's novel, The Red Rover. And then finally it became Le Corsair, suggesting the Byron poem, but in fact having no relation at all. So the overture is laid out along the lines that Berlioz liked a lot in his concert overtures. A hot open, then there's some slow music, and then a big allegro. Now his opening here consists of an alternation of rushing strings and some syncopated things from the winds. Typical Berlioz open. Now, the Adagio, which entered the picture only as late as 1852, and that version of this score is a lovely episode. It goes by much too quickly, but it is revisited at high speed later on. And this is the music that reminds me of what Brahms does. You know how Brahms create these melodies that don't seem to have an ending? They just keep on wandering, meandering. Every time you think you've reached the end of a phrase, he goes, no, actually what I was thinking of is how about this, and then how about that? And he just digresses, and Berlioz does the same thing with this adagio. See if you can find the end of the sentence, the period. And on and on. Then the brilliant Allegro assai has a close cousin in the opening movement of the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique. Mm-hmm. my favorite part of this overture is the final cadence, because there's this bold surprise that Berlioz gives us, which is normal for a Berlioz overture, but this one is Shades of Gustav Mahler. You know the Fifth Symphony? You know how the Fifth Symphony ends? The very end of the Mahler Fifth, where the composer throws us that one last completely unexpected out of left field chord, and then just takes a bow and says, thank you for coming, good night. Well, here's the Mahler. And then, out of nowhere, half century earlier, Berlioz's last moments of the Corsair, proving that there is nothing new under the sun. Curtain raiser to the afternoon's program, the Berlioz Corsair Overture, or as the reviewer might put it, the surrounding ditches must be filled with snakes and toads. And if you came in late, just ask somebody who was here earlier. So, after the Berlioz, we get to be in the same room with Emmanuel Ax. By the way, when he was sitting here 15, 25 minutes ago, dressed in slacks, pullover shirt, he was very polite, said, do you mind if I try this? I said, no, 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 the C is right there. And he laughed. And so it would be worth the price of admission just to be in the same room with Emmanuel Ax, but he's also going to play the Chopin No. 2 for us. Now, the Chopin Concerto No. 2 was actually the Chopin Concerto No. 1. He composed it in 1830 when he was 19 or 20 years old. The premiere took place March of that year in Warsaw. The composer was soloist. And the reason for the 2-1 switcheroo is because the second was published first, and vice versa. A few years later, when he was 24, Chopin wrote to a friend, Mozart encompasses the entire domain of musical creation, but I've only got the keyboard in my poor head. I know my limitations, and I know I'd make a fool of myself if I tried to climb too high without having the ability to it. They plague me to death, urging me to write symphonies and operas, and they want me to be everything in one, a Polish Rossini and a Mozart and Beethoven. But I just laugh under my breath and think to myself that one must start from small things. I'm only a pianist. Luckily for us, the concerto at that time was the star vehicle for young virtuosos, and the public fully expected any instrumentalist worth their salt would follow the path established by the likes of Mozart and Beethoven and others and perform their own original compositions. And the Chopin concertos did the trick. Alas, no one was able to convince him to write that symphony. And the more you listen to the Chopin Concerto No. 2, you realize he would have been a good symphonist, but he had this thing about the piano. Now, it's cast in the standard three movements of the period, fast, slow, fast. The opening movement begins in the manner of a typical Mozart concerto, an orchestral introduction featuring contrasting themes, one that very quickly becomes rather forceful. And not surprisingly, the other is the more lyrical. And when the piano enters, it dominates, using a simple accompaniment under florid piano lines. By the way, we have to wait 3 minutes before Manny Ax starts playing. Noting, one of the very few moments of dialogue in this first movement comes in the development section of the first movement, where the soloist briefly plays a counter melody, and then there's the bassoon. Slow movement, the larghetto, begins very mysteriously in the orchestra. It almost sounds like a mashup. Do you know the opera Bluebeard's Castle by Béla Bartók? Very spooky, moody music. It sounds a little bit like that, a little bit like Wagner's Tristan, and maybe even a quiet moment of Berlioz's Corsair Overture. Piano does soon enter with a phrase of just undiluted romanticism. According to Chopin himself, this melody was directly inspired by an affair of the heart. One of the great pickup lines. There's a more impassioned middle section before the opening mood returns, and then we get the main theme of the final rondo rollicking dance, no doubt a cousin to Chopin's solo piano mazurkas. Everyone has a favorite part in a Chopin concerto. For me, it's the col legno. I like gimmicks. You know about col legno? It's when the strings use the bow, but they use the wood section, they tap it. I don't know why it makes me smile whenever I hear col legno, but it does. I've been to therapists about it, and maybe you have too. So, here it is. It happens in the finale. Then at the end, we get the biggest surprise of the entire movement, if not the entire concerto. It has nothing to do with piano, and I'm sure Emmanuel Ax will forgive me for this, but there's this horn call. You know about the horn call, right? But what makes this so amazing is what leads up to the horn call. What happens is we get the movement obviously coming to an end. You're getting your hands out ready to applaud, and it's still relentlessly in the minor key, and then the sun breaks through. We get this blaze of final major key victory, and it's over, and there's a pause, and you're starting, getting ready to applaud, and then we get the horn call. By the way, if you happen to be sitting next to the person who applauds at that moment, please tell them, you should have come to Caparella's pre-concert. And there's still 3 minutes to go in the concerto, a coda of startling virtuosity. What a way to end a concerto. So we get the concerto number 2 with Emmanuel Axe playing it, about as good as it gets. So that's what we get. Then we get intermission, and we get the bizarre Symphony number 6 by Shostakovich. The work was premiered December 3rd, 1939, Moscow, Evgeny Muravinsky directed. As early as 1924, Shostakovich had toyed with the idea of writing a musical tribute to Lenin. And he made several starts on such a work in the 30s. And then came 36 and a less than favorable official reception to his first opera, Lady Macbeth of Itzensk. The government reaction was a withering attack on his modernism. So, long story short, he wound up apologizing with something called the Symphony No. 5, and that symphony brought him all sorts of letters of congratulation and advice from those who know more about music making than he did in the Soviet Union, and he was basically told, keep on going that way, that's what we need from you, affirmative spirit in your new work. In the Moscow Journal of Soviet Art, November 11, 1938, Shostakovich announced he was undertaking a monumental choral symphony to express through the medium of sound, the immortal image of Lenin as a great son of the Russian people and a great leader and teacher of the masses. Things don't always turn out as planned. The composer announced that he had put off the Lenin symphony because, quote, embodying in art the gigantic figure of this leader is an incredibly difficult task. Next time, come up late for a project from your place of employ, and they say, why are you late? Just say, embodying in art the gigantic figure of this leader is an incredibly difficult task. And they'll say, oh, okay. So, everyone had to wait until Symphony No. 12 in 1961 for a Lenin symphony. Now, the work that people did get to hear finally with this sixth symphony was not some big choral extravaganza, but instead something rather modest in dimensions, featuring no extra musical associations, and by turns, stern, tragic and satiric. And satire, you know, if you know your Soviet history, wasn't really big in the Soviet Union. The symphony came and went with hardly any fanfare at all. It was premiered during the 2-month Festival of Soviet Music in Moscow, and the big hit at that event were the big patriotic cantatas, things like Prokofiev's Alexander Nevsky. But time has been kind to the Shostakovich Sixth. It's increasingly become regarded as one of the Shostakovich best symphonies. Truth be told, it is. In fact, in the review in the LA Times yesterday, this performance by the LA Phil, the reviewer called it bizarre. Why? It's the layout, ladies and gentlemen. The symphony has what you might call an unusual structure. The customary fast opening movement is omitted, so that the work consists only of a long, slow first movement, a scherzo, and a hyperactive finale. That's it. 3 movements. And the first movement is huge compared to the other 2. The opening movement lasts more than a quarter hour, and it's followed by a scherzo lasting 5 minutes, and then what the composer described as a full-blooded and debauched music hall gallop, lasting about 6 or 7 minutes. The critic, Ivan Martinov, felt that the first movement represented the dreary life of the people in Tsarist times, and the later movements their joy under Soviet regime. Even in his purported memoirs, Testimony, 1979, the composer himself had almost nothing to say about the Sixth Symphony, other than remarking upon its general connection with Stalin's numbing brutality, which hung like a pall over the period of the composer's life when the work was conceived. And the influence of Mahler on Shostakovich is plainly evident in the Sixth Symphony. Why so? Well, because of the sparse, chamber-like symphonies. You know, the whole joke about Mahler is he's so big and loud and brassy, when in fact much of Mahler is chamber music. It's just 100 players on stage. Shostakovich does the same thing. A lot of chamber music, a lot of people are sitting around doing Sudoku during the performance. Not really. Anybody from the Philharmonic? Sudoku, so last year. They're doing crosswords again. So there's that, and the juxtaposition of wildly different emotions, all that juxtaposition. The symphony begins with this slow movement, which is actually in two-part form, added to a brief concluding section that returns to the opening themes. But it's not like those two themes, those two parts are, oh, actually, there is a fast movement. No, there isn't. The two motifs that dominate the first section are offered up pretty quickly. One theme, played immediately by the low woodwinds and low strings in unison, features triplets and octave leaps. Octave leap. Violins and flutes, and it has something quite distinctive about it, descending diminished seventh. That was something that Bach and other Baroque composers liked to use to express very deeply felt emotions. But also in that second theme is this nasty piece of business, a snarling trill. This was Shostakovich. These two themes are tossed around in the development without losing their essential nature, and the movement's second section is, for the most part, a series of passages for instruments in solo combinations. We get the English horn, the first to give this theme. It's a dirge-like melody that fluctuates between the major and the minor, once again recalling Mahler. Flutes, the clarinets, the oboes, the violins are given this sad, fragmented melody as this section unfolds. And there's a mournful, almost motionless sigh from the solo horn, which is our signal that we're getting the transition to the close of the pages. To something that is less than a real recapitulation of the opening themes than something of a reminder of their emotional nature. It was Edward Downes who wrote that this Largo is some of the finest music Shostakovich has given us, one of his most thoughtful, least self-conscious, least rhetorical, and most spontaneous symphonic movements. So, and it ends pretty much in that vein we just heard. The second movement is a scherzo, and it is Shostakovich at his biting humor. So the central portion of this second movement, all of 5 minutes long, once again, is distinguished by these awkward rhythmic syncopations and a single pitch, ostinato. The central portion is 1 2-minute long crescendo. Here's just a bit of it. Ostinato. Mm-hmm. that hammers away incessantly with various instrument combinations until the return of the opening part of the scherzo. And then, now again, first movement, about a quarter hour, that scherzo, 5 minutes, and then we get the gigantic 7-minute-long finale. It's exuberant, it's almost ecstatic. In fact, it's sort of drunk, is what it is. It's full of the kind of the wit that one associates mostly with another Russian. This sounds a lot like Prokofiev. These themes are presented and developed before the beginning of a second section, which is this terrific, heavy pounding. I mean, it's just like foot down on the ground kind of three-quarter time dance. Solo violin, that will be Martin Chalavour sitting right over here, and that solo violin unexpectedly, or rather expectedly, brings us back to the opening themes of the finale. The opening theme being... Then we get to the real corker in this movement. Those opening themes are complemented by something on the boisterous side. It's a tune that an author named Richard Rota has described as sounding like a Slavic refugee from a feverish Broadway show. Let me read that again. A Slavic refugee from a feverish Broadway show, which sounds something like this. Something funny happened on the way to the gulag theme. For those who remember that far back. So the symphony ends with the full orchestra diving into this deliberately unsophisticated melody. The ending is one of the most joyous, colorful, unpretentious the composer ever wrote. No bombast, no extra notes, and keep in mind the year that this was produced, 1939. Good times. Good times. They think that's only been three movements, there must be a big finale, tell them you should have come early for Caparella's pre-concert. So once again, our program this afternoon with the LA Philharmonic, led by the way, I believe his name is pronounced Lionel Longuier. I think that's the way you say it. With the Corsair Overture by Berlioz, we get to hear Emmanuel Acts playing the Chopin Concerto No. 2. The reviews are already coming in from these performances, and you're in for a treat. And then we get the Symphony No. 6 by Shostakovich. Thanks once again to the crew, including Lauren and John and all the rest. My name is Richard Caparella from KUSC. Thank you for listening and enjoy the concert.